to Line of Sight. My name is Don Heider. I'm the Executive Director of the Markulis Center for Applied Ethics at Santa Clara University.
And I'm Thane Kreiner, Executive Director of Miller Center for Social Entrepreneurship at Santa Clara University.
We're delighted to have you joining us for our Line of Sight podcast. Today, we have Jean Nyembo, a Jesuit priest who was ordained in 2007. He studied here at the Jesuit School of Theology at Santa Clara University with a focus on social ethics, and he currently leads the Arupe Center for Research and Formation in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. We wanted to welcome you, Jean, to talk a little bit about your work in the Congo. But first, let's start with what attracted you to becoming a Jesuit and the kind of work that you're doing to helping some of the most vulnerable people in the world.
Thank you very much, and I'm happy to be here. Jean Nyembo is my name, a Jesuit priest from the Congo. What attracted me to be a Jesuit, actually a religious guy, a priest? I was born in a period, I grew up in a system of complete dictatorship during the period of Mobutu. And my father was one of the guys, you know, holding the system firm. So I grew seeing experiencing injustice firsthand, and I started as a young boy, you know, getting angry, annoyed about what was happening. So I said, I was telling myself, this should not be the way it is. And I remember having conversations with my dad. I said, no, the system should change. They say, what do you know about politics? What do you know about what is happening? Say, I feel it. And then I started feeling I should commit myself to have a different way of saying things, way of living in the country. And then as I grew, I started to discover that my country was really blessed with whatever we have in there, which many people consider to be today as a curse, but I don't see it as a curse. It is still a blessing, but to see how to use them for the goodness of the people. And that one part. The other, definitely, as a priest, as a religious guy, it was a calling. I felt that's where God was calling me to be, to work for the society and for the salvation of souls.
So when you talk about the natural resources of DR Congo, among them are minerals that are found in our iPhones and our computers and our iPads, like cobalt. So what is life like in cobalt mining communities that we're all dependent on so that we can have our fancy devices?
I like the word fancy, and they are really fancy and they're beautiful, and it's nice to see them. I mean, even a friend of mine say, whatever you see with all these devices just attracts you. It's beautiful. It's seductive.
That Apple design.
Yeah, exactly. But at the same time, when you compare it to the life of the people where these things come, I mean, the raw material is just day and night. The life of the people, they're just totally different from what we see. It's not fancy, not beautiful. It's not nice at all. People suffer a lot. And a lot of it is like from the way this material that come and help us have these nice gadgets. You know, the way they exploit minerals, the way they take them out of, you know, the place is like just not to be that way. And then it leaves a lot of suffering there. Many people suffer because, again, they are used like not like human beings. I mean, like just means of getting these minerals out. And also, this also touch and destroys a lot their space of life, the environment.
So can you talk a little bit more about two examples maybe? So one is they're not using the people as really people, but just to extract the minerals. So what's actually happening when cobalt's coming out of the earth? Who's engaged and how are they engaged? And then you also talked about the extraction of the minerals and the impact on the environment. So there's acidification of the soil, I know from the report that you did. Can you share a little bit more about how that impacts the lives of the people in those communities?
Our century today, I would not imagine human being touch with these minerals directly, like touching with bare hands. It's just a lot of, you know, contact that can destroy directly the life of somebody.
The toxicity of it, the toxicity,
and then everything that is in there. So, yeah. But what I see when I visit those places, and what is really striking and shocking, is to see those kids who are supposed to be in schools, learning to discover the world and what the world can offer out there. They're part of a system that if they don't do that, they won't get means of survival.
No food,
nothing. So it's like they are left with no hope for future, because again, it's like they're tied to this. You do it, you live. You don't do it, you die.
And in the country, are there any groups or the government companies that are concerned about this or no?
Companies and groups and even government, I mean, like, the sad part of it is, like, even people supposed to be protecting these people around, they neglect them, they leave them in that situation, because again, on the other side is like what they get from whoever is doing. Like, I mean, I see these international multinational corporations, all those industries, the way they work with local people around. So people in position, they ignore the people who work in the mines, and then they work more with all these corporations. So again, they become like a very strong hand to them, not to the people who are working locally in the mines. Like tech women, I spoke about children, women, even pregnant women. You find them there, because if they don't do that, there's nothing to do.
There's no income.
But nobody addresses that as an issue. In fact, there are people without identity, without face, without name.
But people, everybody's aware of it, but it's ignored.
People know what's happening, but they ignore it. You shut your mouth, because if you talk about it, there is something that, you know, we'll be lost in the whole chain. But the shock I have is, like, today we can do that job. I mean, we need this. I have a mobile phone. I have a tablet. We need those things our day to day. But there is a different way of getting this out of without affecting the life of the people. In fact, it should help them, because again, this is the place, all this land, they were doing other activities before these mining activities came. They were, you know, in agriculture and farming, but all these have disappeared.
And they've disappeared partly because of the environmental impacts of the mines?
How would you farm in a land, or even fishing in a place where water is polluted?
With the heavy minerals.
That comes from the industry.
The acidification.
And even before they start the work of, you know, all these mining activities, the first thing they do is just cut all the trees that are around. So if you don't have
deforestation,
and then there is no way you can think even of, you know, farming activities. And then that affects also the season of, like, rains, for instance.
Without the forest.
Yeah, exactly. So everything is, the ecosystem is touches, I mean, devastated, and then that touch a lot on the way people live on the ground. So there are a lot of, let's say, challenges and questions that come from the way we are doing the mining today.
So before the mines were there, what I heard you say is that people were working in agro-pastoral activities, growing food locally, working in the forest to get things that they needed. And because of the mines, they can't do that anymore. And so the only way that they can buy food now, some of it which I understand is coming from over the border in Zambia, is by working in the mines or working in artisanal mining illegally to earn some income to buy their food.
Exactly. I'm just new in Lubumbashi, Katanga. This is now my fifth year. I asked my senior brothers, Jesuit, who are from that place. They have known a period where food will come from Congo and cross the border, and people would eat everything that was produced there in the Congo and those places. But today it's the other way around. We get everything, and I'm ashamed to say that when I go to Kasumbalesa border, what I see just is a shame. We get everything from there. You know, you can imagine whatever that one might need in their house. And now to get that food, they need money. And where does that money come from? Again, it's like a slavery, to use a very strong word, to the system. The system enslaves them, so that you get some money and then spend it to buy what they were producing before,
right,
which is a horrible situation.
So how do you think about this, Don, from an ethics perspective? That here we are in Silicon Valley with a lot of firms that are using cobalt and tantalum and gold in our devices and for the computer chips that run in our cloud storage and all of that. What's the responsibility of the firms, and what's our responsibility as consumers to the people who are living in these communities?
Well, I think it's striking the lack of awareness. So that I think most consumers don't understand where anything in their phone comes from, or even how it's powered. Mm-hmm. And so it's shocking to me, how low our level of awareness is, right? And also that companies that use some of the devices, some of which purport to be ethical companies and have an ethical grounding and try to treat their own workers ethically here, mm-hmm. Are taking, sounds like, zero responsibility for the supply chain that is providing mm-hmm. these raw materials, mm-hmm. which are so essential for the product.
But there are some responsible sourcing initiatives, mm-hmm. and the study you did, Jean, with Jacques, you found that the responsible sourcing initiatives are not actually something that community members want.
First of all, they are not even aware of.
And they're not even aware of them.
And okay. Then the second thing is it does not affect them anyways. It does not touch them. It can be, you have those. But as a community, as members of the community, they don't see how that helps them, first of all, because, again, it does not concern and touch on their lives. Uh-huh. One could think, for instance, if really responsible sourcing of cobalt and minerals was there, the first step would be to see how the members of the communities affected are dragged into the industrial chains of right. production, and then you give them the knowledge that they need. You train them, you equip them so that they can be real producers in the proper chain. But they are not. That's why they say, this is not for us. Mm-hmm. And this does not help us at all.
So it's really kind of responsible sourcing in name only. It's like a fair trade label that's not really fair trade.
If we look at it through the lenses of communities, local communities affected, yeah, that will be the answer.
And so I guess I would ask, from your formation as a Jesuit, is there another lens to look at it through other than the people who live in the communities? I don't think so.
It's hard because, again, as a Jesuit, and maybe you could use another one, as a Jesuit, as a priest, my first concern will be the people down there.
It should be our first concern.
Exactly. So it's like the voices of the people that we are using here, not of any other interest.
I'm curious about your story, and that sounds like at a very young age you had a very strong sense of moral outrage mm-hmm. over what was going on yeah. in your country. Mm-hmm. Do you think that's unusual among folks you knew growing up? And where do you think that came from? Do you think it was a sort of divine intervention?
I come from a large family, and not all my brothers react the same way. But when I look at, those who join religious life and my peer, my friends, we started training together, we have different stories. And some will be more interested in other aspect than this, that touch directly on people's life. Divine intervention, I don't know, but this is kind of sensitivity that I was born with, I grew up with, and it does not, I've seen, even academically, topics and subjects that I was attracted to were related to that. Even when I did my philosophy, theology in Berkeley, I did social ethics, while other people will come for fundamental theology, which is great. I mean, but for me, it was social ethics. And the ethics of social reconciliation, for instance, anything that touches directly on human life and the way we live, and this is where I see God expressing himself. I mean, I don't see God otherwise than through the people. If they are happy, that means God is happy. If they are not happy, if they suffer, that means the cross, Jesus on the cross continued to, shake his body, because a lot of spears, a lot of suffering into his body through the people that we see. And that's what I'm still into even now.
And this is an issue I'm new to, but it seems to me that if companies decided to
ban natural resources from unethical mining, they can certainly do so. Or is that too simplistic an answer?
Well, it's a good question, and I think we can turn to Jean. I don't know if it's possible to simply ban them, or if there are ways that companies could work together to hold the mining companies more accountable for the dignity of the communities from which the minerals are extracted. I mean, if we didn't have cobalt, we wouldn't have phones. And would consumers rebel at not having phones? I think there's another inherent question. Are people willing to pay more to have their phones and their devices so that people who are doing the hard work of extracting the minerals can have better livelihoods and that children can go to school and that people can grow food like they used to because the mining companies are taking responsibility for the externalities of their actions in these environments. So I don't know if you could just ban it because how much of the world's cobalt does DR Congo produce? It's a pretty large percentage.
I would say a lot. I mean, so we are the first producer now. I mean, for what I know, it can be debated, but a lot that comes from Congo. And then when you say banning, I mean, every country lives from what they have.
Right.
Some it will be tourism and other things. You say, I ban it. No, there is a problem. There is a way to solve it.
Yeah.
When we look at how the social teaching of the church started with Rerum Novarum, I mean, Leo XIII was addressing the way workers were treated in industries. He attacked the problem. Solutions were found. These many countries, like, they have moved away from that problem. We did not suppress the situation. It's like, solve it. And I think there is a way of solving the problem.
Yeah.
And we are talking about a small, it's not a huge community. Those who work in the mining representing, I mean, I don't know, in terms of population, it's a very small number of people. And there can be a solution for this. Mm-hmm. Now, I guess it's like the easiest way for many industries to go is like use them, get a lot of money out of the system, and then they ignore about them. But I am convinced taking care of these people, solving this problem does not take all the money from industries and does not take all the energy, because I think technology, the knowledge is there to solve this problem.
So that was kind of the vision behind you founding the Center Arupe a little over 5 years ago. Is that right?
Exactly.
So can you talk about what you want to achieve with the Center Arupe? Because, I mean, so far this sounds pretty depressing maybe for our podcast listeners that you're listening to this on your phone and children and women are dying, pregnant women are helping get the cobalt out of the earth, and it's an intractable problem, and do we just ban it and then people won't have any jobs at all? But there's a different vision that you have with Center Arupe, which is that we can have our phones and people can have dignified livelihoods. So tell us what that looks like.
Center Arupe is just one center amongst what we call in the Society of Jesus Social Apostolate, and we have a lot of centers, and it came from another center in Kinshasa, CEPAS, which was doing a lot of research before, since the independence, 1960s. Now, Arupe coming in Lubumbashi, this period, because we realized that there was this gap we need to fill. And then look at the way people live and the problems that we are talking about here. We said there is a call there, and then we have to go to this place and look what are the specific problems of the people and the solutions that we can craft. And what we are doing right now is just envisioning a different way for people to engage in this. These are vital, let's say, sectors and domains of life. Yes,
right.
Definitely. But it's how now to change the way we do the mining. It's like a revisioning the way we do it, and also try to see how to re-equip people to rebuild again the dignity that they've been losing, the way they've been treated in the mines. So that's the kind of vision we are in. It's about human being, dignified human being lives.
So that's restoring dignity.
Restoring dignity to the community. Again, we're still talking about, you know, rebuilding those fabrics that have been broken. Mm-hmm. Social fabric and, you know,
environmental,
you know,
cultural
It's about rebuilding it, because without it, we can't talk even about of a society, a viable society. There is none. If you have only pieces that are scattered all over, we know as Jesuits, we commit not only Santa Rupe, but as we have a vocation to work with the people. It's not a project for 1 year. We work with people all through.
And you use art and music and drama as part of this?
This is an integrated program now. You know, like the center there has a vocation to cover so many things. And then especially when we talk about the youth today, what are they interested in? What are the things that attract their attention? We don't create sophisticated things. It's just use what is of interest for them. Before I came here, I even organized, there was this fashion week. And I work with people, creative minds, now how they express themselves in, you know, producing what attracts people. I say, how now can we work with them to, you know, help them do it the proper way? So those are the sections of life that we are interested in.
And you've also talked about restoring the ability for people to grow and produce food that they can feed their families with and sell to generate income too. So what does that look like, and who would be most who would most benefit from those kinds of programs?
There'll be the people themselves will be the beneficiaries of this, because we think of them as being agents of their own development, and then it's not something that has to be important from wherever. But people like us and others, other partners who feel like they can really join into this work, is really help people construct their own life, and they take part in that process themselves. And I think there is a lot of joy in there when you see like you are really helping somebody to regain in humanity. Mm-hmm. I mean, there is not a big accomplishment than that. I mean, it's really interesting and beautiful that one would want to invest in.
So here you are in the heart of Silicon Valley with us, and you were here before when you were at Jesuit School of Theology studying. What would you like to see large corporations do, given this problem of artisanal and industrial mining and the negative impact on the communities?
I know a lot of these things, you know, what people in the global West and these places, people read a lot, and the knowledge we know we have is from what we read. I'm bringing a voice. I'm just becoming here. I'm using the voice of people who could not make it to this place. Mm-hmm. And then just let people listen to their cry. Mm-hmm. And I still believe corporations, people here in the Silicon Valley, they'll be really happy and even proud to know that where they are putting the steps on, like in those places, there is flourishing life, beautiful life. It's just beautiful to see beautiful faces of people's kids who smile because they know, yeah, really, you are giving me a good hand. And I think corporations here, many people here can help into that. And they'll be really proud to tell the world, yes, not only we take this raw material, not only we produce nice gadgets that we are using, we are also promoting human life, which is beautiful.
Mm-hmm. So, Don, how do you think about the ethics of supply chain management for Silicon Valley firms, and what could they do to become more aware of both the problems and help work with centers like Center Arupe to create solutions?
I think they definitely could. I think the temptation is to only take the supply chain down so far. Mm. And so because they contract with mining companies, they're able to sort of wash their hands of responsibility.
So the mining companies are the ones who... Yeah.
And we've seen this in other sectors of tech, for instance, content moderation. They often have a contract with third-party companies that work in the developing world.
When you say content moderation, you're talking about the big Facebook, Twitter.
Exactly. Yeah. And YouTube. And there's hours and hundreds of thousands and millions of posts every day. And so there aren't enough humans to do it. So they use AI, but then they also contract with third parties.
countries, oftentimes in the developing world, to look at the objectionable content sent in front of a computer screen for hours and hours and make content decisions based on some set of criteria. Mm-hmm. So, but again, the companies say, well, it's not our responsibility. It's this third party contractor that is. I see sort of a similar pattern here in that they and I think that that may only change with a sense of public outrage. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think about some of the good work that's been done exposing sweatshops or exposing child labor practices.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And I think that work can bring about incredible public pressure that then may force the company's hand to take responsibility. We see companies starting to open up to ethics training, a few companies, it's not widespread yet, because of multiple pressure points. They're afraid of regulation. Their own employees are upset. They're, I think, more and more like the EU is imposing bigger and bigger fines. Mm-hmm. So all those multiple pressure points are causing some companies to finally open their doors to ethics training, for instance. Mm-hmm. I think we could see the same phenomenon in terms of this.
In the supply chain.
In the supply chain, yeah. There has to be exposure to the public, I think.
Of what the problems are.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And sort of a sense of public outrage that this is going on.
Mm-hmm. So a lot of the, like, big crises with sweatshops that you talked about and child labor, those have involved products with fairly simple supply chains, like clothes, right? And we all remember the big fire in Bangladesh. But when you talk about a phone or a tablet or a computer, there's literally thousands, if not tens of thousands, of different suppliers. So one could have made the argument that it's impossible to know about all of those, but with technology and AI, that's no longer true, is it?
Right. Well, I'll say this. Even in, let's talk about sweatshops for a second. You can shut down a sweatshop or stop, you know, buying from, and it'll just move to a different sweatshop, right? And so that's part of the problem.
And then those people don't have any job at all, which is similar to what we heard from John, that if you put these responsible sourcing initiatives in place, then people have no livelihood because their other ones have been destroyed by the mining already.
Correct. I mean, I think the only advantage I see here is there are only so many places where these minerals are produced. And so it would be more difficult to sort of close up operations and move someplace else, right? So we can sort of pinpoint where the issue is. I think that's hopeful because, again, I think that if pressure was brought on the government, on the companies, and also helping people feel empowered in country, then I think you might have, you know, enough of a groundswell to maybe bring about change.
Yeah, and so that sort of links back to what Jean talked about, is that ultimately we're talking about these communities and we know where they are and we know the people who, well, Jean knows the people who live in them and who are working there, and we could have a real profound impact by working with those people to create alternatives to mining and making the mining much more safe and much less damaging. And maybe the mining companies won't do that directly, but maybe the corporations that are buying from them can put pressure on their suppliers.
I agree. And one thing is, like, thinking of corporations here, like, one simple thing they can ask, how many people locally do you hire? And this can be, you know, they can check on whether it's right or wrong.
Yeah. So you just brought that up, but that, we haven't really talked about that. So the mining companies are not really hiring local people. And why is that?
Okay, they say they are not trained, they are not equipped, they don't have the proper knowledge. I mean, these are things that we can give people, and they don't want to invest in there.
They could invest.
They
in
could invest in training there. So there is a program that could be put in place, so that at least you don't say. I mean, many have been working there for years, and then all years you don't even have one who could be trained there and then to enter your industry. Yeah. So when you say how many do you hire, that means what is the program that we have put in place to prepare them so that they could be, you know, people that could help in your work, whatever, to produce them.
Well, thank you. I think, John, you've given us some very concrete ideas for ways that we can address this really difficult problem of minerals like cobalt, tantalum, and gold coming from regions where people are basically acting as modern-day slaves and creating dignified livelihoods for them through alternatives through social entrepreneurship, through sustainable agriculture, and also engaging corporations here in Silicon Valley to put pressure on their suppliers and not basically absolve themselves of responsibilities because it's a third party. There aren't that many mines, as Don pointed out, and there aren't that many mining companies either.
Thanks for the amazing work you're doing.
Thank you very much.
It's a delight to have you with us.
Thank you very much, and thank you for giving this opportunity.